Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. This show will first be broadcast on Wednesday, January 1st, 2025, on 91.7 FM WHUS Doors. Happy New Year! Also, happy Hanukkah and happy Kwanzaa to those who celebrate, because those holidays are still ongoing. I'm Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. My co-host Ron Meniza has one more week of teaching a fitness class when we usually record. We'll be back to recording together in 2 weeks. We're coming to you live from beautiful Mansfield Hollow, Connecticut. Comment below to let us know you're here and ask questions. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, and Buzzsprout. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at Fran Storch ND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Okay, so health update. Things are pretty good. I recently went to the dentist, and the dentist, they take your blood pressure. I guess because it's another way to get checked and make sure your blood pressure is okay. And also, they shouldn't give you epinephrine to make carbocaine or novocaine stay longer if your blood pressure is elevated. But I don't need epinephrine because it makes me wired. And also, my metabolism is slow enough that she gives me carbocaine and it stays long enough for her to do whatever procedure she needed. Thing is, my blood pressure was mildly elevated today. My systolic was up in the 150s. My diastolic was in the 80s, which is better than it's been at the dentist's office. Although she did take my blood pressure after I had rushed in, had trouble making a left turn to get to the dentist. And so I was a little stressed when I sat down. She didn't let me sit and breathe for a little bit, which is really what you're supposed to do. You're not supposed to like take your patient's blood pressure as soon as they sit down. You're supposed to let them sit and breathe and relax for a little bit. And when they take my blood pressure at Dr. LaGuardia's office, they don't take it first thing. They let me, I'm in there for a while before they actually take it. And my blood pressure is usually pretty good, which is why they didn't raise my dose. So I'm on the 5 milligrams of lisinopril, and I haven't been monitoring my blood pressure at home because the blood pressure symptoms I was having are better. But I think I should start monitoring it again and see if I need to go up to 7.5. Because I'm doing okay with the 5. I cough occasionally, which is a side effect of lisinopril, but it's not bad. And if I drink enough water, it doesn't happen. So I really need to stay hydrated. And the thing is, while taking this, I found that staying hydrated is critical, that I don't feel well if I don't make sure to stay hydrated. So we're going to hydrate. Electrolytes most of the time. So I have gentle electrolytes and not, you know, they're not real heavy electrolytes and they're not extremely citric acidy, which is bad for your teeth. So I really love this brand that I'm using, which I can't say because this is community radio. But I'm very happy with these electrolytes because that's the next thing I wanted to talk about. And that's that I had a good dental checkup. I had one tooth that has ongoing, had a bunch of decay, and now it's time to put a crown on it, but that was coming up anyway. But there was no new decay. Why? And what changed this time is I diligently, in the last 6 months since my last prophylaxis, started using this great toothpaste nearly every day. And I don't brush with it. I brush with a less expensive regular toothpaste, a regular natural toothpaste, because I can't tolerate it. It's amazing how many chemicals there are in commercial supermarket toothpaste. So there's red dye, blue dye, yellow dye, all kinds of chemicals. And it's really kind of concerning. So I like to use natural toothpaste, I'll just say health food store brands. I have a couple of favorite brands, which I can't say, that feature xylitol and other good ingredients, and they're not too expensive. So the one that I use that's more expensive is one from a supplement company that I deal with, and it has great ingredients in it, and I don't use it to brush. I use it as a leave-on. Leave-on wears his war wounds like a crown. Anyway, so I use it as a leave-on. So I brush my teeth, I floss, I pick, I I use a water flosser, then I use a rinse that has tea tree oil and other herbal ingredients in it. And in that, there's a powder that I put in that's remineralizing, and I swish, and then I gargle that. And then when I'm all done, I use this paste as a leave-on. And it's better it's you can use it any time of day, but it's a really good idea to use it at night because you're not going to be eating all night, and it sits there and it's not going to be disturbed while it sits and remineralizes your teeth. So this toothpaste has hydrated silica in it, which is to help with remineralization. It has hydroxyapatite, and hydroxyapatite is shown to be on par with fluoride for remineralizing teeth. So I'm very pleased with that. And then it has, let's see what else, xylitol. Xylitol breaks up plaque. You want to, if you have dogs, you need to keep this toothpaste away from your dogs. And then it has some stevia in it to make it a little sweet. Has another form of calcium, the calcium glycerophosphate. Then it has spearmint oil to make it taste reasonable. It tastes okay. It doesn't taste as good as the xylitol spearmint toothpaste that I use, but that it's good enough that I can stand it. The lemon flavor of this I'm not crazy about. And then it has some bicarbonate in it. That's going to be a little bit abrasive to get rid of your plaque and your gook in your mouth. Then it has some CoQ10, some ubiquinone. Then it has something that's very important, Lactobacillus paracasei. So I think that this is critical because what my dental hygienist Kim thinks is that my immune system is just not working right in my mouth. And the addition of this special probiotic may have been key in helping me. So between the hydroxyapatite and the Lactobacillus paracasei, I think those are the two most important ingredients in this toothpaste. It has a brand name, but if you can find this toothpaste in particular, but look for toothpaste that have Lactobacillus paracasei, or look for lozenges that have it in it. And so probiotic that you can put in your mouth and suck on, or get powder that has Lactobacillus paracasei in it. Anyway, so that's the strain that's known as Dental Lac. So it's going to compete with strep mutans and other bacteria that can give you decay in your mouth. So getting that on board. I had a patient come in not too long ago who had dysgeusia. So dysgeusia it's a great word. Dysgeusia is she had disordered taste. She had a bad taste in her mouth and she didn't know what was causing it. So I said, that's interesting. It could be some low-grade inflammation in your mouth. It could be coming from your sinuses. It could be that you have some, you have dysbiosis, you have bad flora in your mouth. So why don't you try this toothpaste? And I instructed her on how to use it as a leave-on. And she did. Then she came back a few weeks later and said to me, it worked. No more bad taste in my mouth. I said, wow, that's interesting. So it corrected her I'm assuming it corrected her microbiome in her mouth. That's and because of the Lactobacillus paracasei. There's also antimicrobials in this. The xylitol is going to be antimicrobial. It's going to break up plaque. And then there's also silver in this. There's purified silver, and the silver is going to kill bad bacteria. There's also Bixa orellana seed extract, which is GG. That's geraniol. And geraniol rebuilds soft tissue. And you can take that to help with age-related sarcopenia. So as we get older, we tend to lose muscle mass. And as that's happening, GG is something you can take orally to help to reduce age-related sarcopenia. Well, if you put it on topically, it's going to help to reduce the loss of tissue, of gum tissue. So that's why it's in there. And then let's see, there's hydrolyzed gardenia florida in there. I'm not sure why that's in there. And then the Vitis vinifera is grapeseed extract. So grapeseed extract is a terrific antioxidant. It's going to help to strengthen the blood vessels and the tissue of the gums. So I've been using this as a leave-on for the last 6 months, almost every day. Sometimes I miss, but most days it goes in, and it may go in the morning and it may go in the evening, but I've been doing it pretty much every day. And I think it made a difference, which is very exciting. So if I go another cycle, so my next prophylaxis is in June. And if I go another cycle with no new decay, I'll be thrilled. I'll be absolutely thrilled. I think it can be 61 years old and maintain the teeth that I have and not have to worry about getting implants. Because I just heard some stories about people getting implants. There's a big implant chain that people are suing them because of certain practices. So, and you know, implants are really rough. You know, you have to have your teeth removed, and then you have a stud put in, and then they build porcelain teeth that don't decay around them. And some people need those. Probably be a good thing for Ron and my sister-in-law because of their tooth status. But I'm hoping not to have to go there. Anyway, so if this works, I will be so thrilled. And I will be calling the company and saying, would you like me to hawk this product for you? Yeah, there's two products that I would be happy to hawk. And one of them is this toothpaste that I'm not showing you. And the other one is these electrolytes, these very mild electrolytes that have, they're just basically, you know, salt and a little salt, Himalayan salt, a little potassium, a little stevia, a little flavor, trace minerals. Very good, very mild, very, very easy to drink. And I can drink them all day. And I drank them for, I was concerned because there is a little citric acid. They usually put citric acid in flavored electrolytes to give it a little tartness. So you want to drink it. It gives it a little flavor. And I was concerned the citric acid because Kim has warned me about the citric acid in sport drinks. Well, guess what? I've been drinking this regularly, pretty much every day since October. And again, great dental checkup. So the key there is the remineralization that I think is happening with the hydroxyapatite. And I think the hydroxyapatite for me, I'm not going to say it's better than fluoride. I think it's on par with fluoride. There's concerns that fluoride could be neurotoxic. One of the things that's a concern, and I talked to Kim about this, is that with the new administration coming in, there's talk of removing fluoride from city water supplies, and that's fraught. On the one hand, I see the point because there's some evidence that fluoride can be neurotoxic, but it's neurotoxic in large amounts. On the other hand, I asked my patients who are dental hygienists, and I asked Kim this question today, because you ever go to the dentist and they do that, they poke at your teeth in three spots on both sides and they count numbers. They go 3-2-3, 3-1-3, 2-1-2, 3-1-2, 3-2-1, 3-1-2, like that, right? What they're doing is it's simply the number of millimeters that your gums have pulled away from your teeth. And the more inflammation there is in your gums, the more they will have pulled away. So the best number to get is one. And I had, all of my teeth were threes, ones and twos, except for a couple of my wisdom teeth, which had some fours. So I just have to get back there and get the floss in and get the pick in. But to have a high of four and only on the wisdom teeth was very good. So I ask my dental hygienist patients, and I have a few of those, and I ask my own dental hygienist, Kim, so how good are people about flossing and picking? And I told her, I asked my patients who are dental hygienists this, so what do people say? And she said, they're bad. Most people don't do it regularly. I'm like, aha, so I'm pretty good about it. So I just want to say to you, it's really important to floss your teeth. You can't just brush. It's really important to floss it because you need to pull the gums away from the tooth surfaces, because the bacteria that grows that causes cavities is anaerobic. And when you floss, you're going to remove debris that the strep mutans bacteria is going to munch on and create plaque. And you're going to also aerate the space between. You're getting oxygen in there, and because the bacteria, strep mutans bacteria and other bacteria that cause cavities, are anaerobic. So if you get oxygen on them, they will die. So flossing is important for that. You will have less decay if you floss. It's not just about getting the extra stuff out of your teeth. It's about aerating and getting rid of the bad bacteria. Getting rid of the bad bacteria in your mouth is really a good thing. You have a microbiome in your mouth, and that Lactobacillus paracasei is important. If you get that in there, it will fight off the strep mutans that tends to cause decay. It's really important to do. And so if you do that as well as flossing, and you know, I floss, pick, and water floss. You probably don't have to do all three of those. If you just do, I wouldn't recommend only picking. I would recommend, but I recommend if you want to pick one, it's probably regular floss. If you can't be bothered, then try water flossing. But if you can do 2 to 3 of those, that's ideal. But most people aren't going to do that because most people aren't even doing one of them. So please pick one that you will do. I think it's more important to floss or water floss than it is to pick. Although if you could floss or water floss and pick, that's better. And then to the rinsing is probably optional. I choose to rinse because I also like to gargle. gargling is also to get rid of respiratory viruses, to keep me from getting sick. But when you rinse your mouth, you're going to kill extra bacteria too. And then after that, you apply something with Lactobacillus paracasei, whether it's a lozenge or this toothpaste that you leave in, and then you're going to get set up with the Lactobacillus paracasei, which is going to fight off the bad bacteria for you. So I was really thrilled with that checkup. So look into toothpastes, if you would, with Lactobacillus paracasei in it, and also with calcium hydroxyapatite in them. Those are the two big ingredients that you want to look for. All right, so that was exciting. All right, so poor Ron, we're still waiting for results on, he's now scheduled to have a test. He's going to have an ankle brachial test, which compares the blood pressure in his ankle and his arm. And if one is higher than the other, that would suggest, and what will probably happen, that the pressure in his arm would be higher than the pressure in his ankle if he has peripheral artery disease in his legs. The blood pressure is going to be lower in his legs. So if that turns out, so he's scheduled to have that done. And once he has that done, we'll have some idea of whether he has peripheral artery disease, and that can be corrected. And he may be done and they'll be able to treat him based on that, or he may then have to have an exercise test. So we'll see what happens. All right. So Happy New Year. You're listening to this. If you're listening to WHUS, this is your New Year's companion. I'm wishing you all a very happy 2025. Welcome to the new year. I hope this is a good one. I hope we can figure out how to get along better as a country and we can have some fun. If you notice, if you happen to be watching my Facebook Live or Instagram Live, you notice that I'm wearing a Hanukkah shirt. That is because on today, when this episode drops, it is New Year's Day, and it also happens to still be Hanukkah. Hanukkah began on Christmas night. So it began on the evening of the 25th, which is probably the 15th. I think it's the 15th of Kislev. I'm not exactly sure. But it started on the evening of December 25th and will finish on the evening of January 2nd. So tomorrow, January 2nd, at sundown, it will end, because in the Hebrew calendar in Israel, days begin at sundown. They go from sundown to sundown. And so if it's a holiday, the holiday starts the night before and finishes at sundown the next day. That's what Shabbos does. So in the winter, a holiday is longer, right? Yeah. It's longer in the winter because it starts at the sundown is very early. Well, maybe. Is that true? Maybe it's not true. It's still 24 because the sunset is at the same time both days. Never mind. That was silly. But anyway, it is still Hanukkah, so that's exciting. And on the 26th, Kwanzaa began, and Kwanzaa goes through today, the 1st. So here's a little history. You know, it's probably New Year's Day for you. Hopefully you're hanging around the house. Maybe you partied last night. Maybe you're having a New Year's gathering today. Some people have traditional dinners at New Year's. They hang out with family or friends. Or maybe you're just crashing and relaxing and having a chill day because you're not working. Or maybe you're working and this is your work companion. So I'm honored if you're listening to me. So here's a little more on the history of Hanukkah, because it is still Hanukkah. So the celebration known as Hanukkah commemorates the rededication during the second century BC. So we don't say BC because that means before Christ. It's okay if you say BC and that's what you do because you're Christian. It's fine. We just don't say it because Christ is not part of our religion. We say BCE. CE means the common era. So instead of BC and AD, so BC is before Christ. And AD is Anno Domini, and in Latin, which means the year of our Lord. We don't say that because he's not our Lord, he's your Lord, which is fine. So BCE is before the common era, and CE is the common era. That's what we say instead of AD. So the Hanukkah celebrates the rededication of the second temple in Jerusalem. So the legend says that Jews had risen up against the Greek Syrian oppressors in the Maccabean revolt. The Maccabean people were, the Maccabees like a hammer. Hanukkah means dedication in Hebrew, begins on, I'm sorry, now I just found out, 25th of Kislev. And falls in November or December, and it varies because it depends on whether The preceding year was a leap year, and this year, the preceding year was a leap year, because you add an extra month, and because you add an extra month, everything until the month of Adar in the next year is pushed forward. And then after Adar, for example, Passover is going to be earlier, and it's going to be earlier until there is another leap year. And so the order of leap years is kind of weird. It's not every 4 years. But there's a system to it because you have to add a whole month. So anyway, this year, 5785 is not a leap year, but last year, 5784 was. And so that's why everything's so late this year. It's late, and it's only late in the Gregorian calendar. It's the same date in the Hebrew calendar. So 25th of Kislev, and as I said, it begins on the night of December 25th and finishes on the night of January 2nd. So it took the events that inspired Hanukkah took place during a pretty turbulent phase of Jewish history. Around 200 BCE, Judea, which was known as the Land of Israel, came under the control of Antiochus III, who was one of the Xerxes. The Seleucid king of Syria, who allowed the Jews that lived there to continue practicing their religion. Antiochus IV, Epiphanes, was less benevolent and outlawed the Jewish religion and ordered the Jews to worship Greek gods. That doesn't go over too well in Judaism. So then in 168 BCE, the soldiers descended upon Jerusalem and massacred thousands of people and desecrated the city's holy second temple and erected an altar to Zeus and sacrificed pigs, which are not kosher, in its sacred walls. That wasn't nice. So led by the Jewish priest Mattathiah and his five sons, a large-scale rebellion broke out against Antiochus and the Seleucid monarchy. When Mattathiah died in 166, his son Yehuda, also known as Judah Maccabee, or Yehuda, the hammer, the Hebrew hammer, took the helm, and within 2 years, the Jews had successfully driven the Syrians out of Jerusalem, relying on guerrilla warfare tactics. Judah called on his followers to cleanse the second temple, rebuild its altar, and light the menorah, which is the golden candelabrum, whose seven branches represented knowledge and creation and were meant to be burning every single night. So the Hanukkah miracle, according to the Talmud, so this may not be true, it may just be a story. It doesn't matter because it is the story. It's okay. So the Jews witnessed what they thought was a miracle. Even though there was only enough untainted olive oil to keep the menorah's lights burning for one day, the flames continued flickering for 8 nights, which gave them time to find a fresh supply, to go out to the countryside where the olives grew and get more olives for olive oil. The first book of Maccabees tells another story describing an 8-day celebration that followed the rededication with no mention of the oil. So there's other interpretations of the story. Some modern historians have a radically different interpretation. In their view, Jerusalem under Antiochus IV had civil war between two camps of Jews, the assimilated ones and those and who adopted Greek and Syrian customs, and those who were determined to impose Jewish laws and traditions, even if by force. The traditionals won out in the end with the Hasmonean dynasty, who was led by Judah Maccabee's brother and descendants, wresting the control of the land of Israel from the Seleucids and maintaining an independent Jewish... I never heard that before. Jewish scholars have also suggested the first Hanukkah may have been a belated celebration of Sukkot, which would be pretty late because Sukkot happens in... It's in Tishri. It's a week after the high holidays. And that was in October. It's 2 months ago. Which the Jews hadn't had a chance to observe since the Maccabean revolt. So the Hanukkah celebration revolves around the kindling of a 9-branched menorah, which is known as Chanukiah. And on each of the holidays, a menorah in Jewish is simply a candelabra that has multiple lights on it. So an everyday menorah generally has So if you're looking at my shirt, you can see that what you see on my shirt here, it's a Chanukiah. So you notice that there's 4 candles on either side of a central candle called the Shamash. Well, an everyday menorah has 7 branches on it. So there's 3 on either side of a Shamash. But this represents the 8 nights of Hanukkah. So that's what a Chanukiah looks like. On each of the holidays eight night, another candle is added to the menorah after sundown, and the ninth candle, called the shamash, which is a helper, is used to light the others. And we recite a blessing during the ritual and display the menorah prominently in a window. And the tradition in the U.S., I'm not sure what they do all over the world, but what we do is we light actual fire candles in the house, and then we have an electric menorah that sits in the window, because it's easier to deal with an electric menorah. That is because you can attach it to the window and then you just light up it. Since I was a kid, you know, 50 odd years ago, my whole life, we always had an electric menorah. And so I have an electric menorah now. When I was a kid, the bulbs were orange. Now, the one I have now, the bulbs are blue, and we make sure we have, I should probably check the lights to make sure they all function. And if they're not, I have to get, you know, extra bulbs. So you're supposed to light them in the window, and you let people know that it's Hanukkah. And when you put it in the window, so what you do is, because Hebrew reading goes from right to left, so you light, you take the shamash and you light for the first night, you light the candles in order, starting from right to left for the fire one that you light in your house. The one that's attached to your window, you light them from left to right so that they look right to left from outside. So you do it the opposite way in the window, only because you want it to be seen from right to left on the outside. So the other thing we do is we eat food fried in oil. Yum, yum, yum. So you eat potato pancakes, also known as latkes, which are super delicious. They are, you know, they can have matzah meal in them to stick them together. If you're gluten-free, they'll have gluten-free flour in them. And they usually have egg. And if you can tolerate onions, they have onion in them. We don't put onions in mine because I can't tolerate onions. And, you know, Ron can add onion seasoning to his if he wants to. So, and you can make them with ground potatoes. You can grind the potatoes into a powder, or you can grate them. What's easier than grating is now we have food processors, so you can do it that way. So I like them better when they're in shreds, and then you have the shreds stuck together. That they're delicious that way. And so they're, you know, potato pancakes that are stuck together with egg and some kind of flour, either matzah meal or gluten-free flour. And they might have traditionally onions as well. Not necessarily. And they can be made out of white potatoes. They can also be made out of sweet potatoes. It's a little less traditional, but it's done. And then you can put whatever you want on top of them. Traditionally, we put sour cream on them, because in Eastern Europe, we ate sour cream. And we also put applesauce on them. That's traditional. But of course, you could put whatever you want on them. If you want to put cheese on them, or if you want to put jam on them, if you want to put apple butter on them, or any flavor butter, you can do that too. Anything that's going to taste good on a potato. And the potatoes, even if they're white potatoes, I'm telling you, they taste good sweet or sour. And what I tend to do is I'll take one. Now, sour cream I don't really do, because I'm not great with that level of dairy. So what I do is I get unsweetened coconut-based yogurt, and I have a favorite brand that tastes the sourest and the most like sour cream, so that's what I use. And in fact, when I was still eating dairy, I preferred to get actual yogurt, because sour cream we didn't really use. We didn't really eat a lot, but like if I get a container of regular yogurt for Ron, he'll eat it. He'll put it in his oatmeal or something, and I will eat regular yogurt. I'll eat yogurt too for another meal. So we tend to put yogurt on it. It's still sour, a sour milk product. Tastes really good on it. What I tend to do is I'll do half and half. I'll do one side with sour cream and the other side with the applesauce. So the other thing you eat, and so the Eastern Europe, we had a lot of potatoes. So Eastern European Jews are people like me. They speak Yiddish. We speak Yiddish, which is a mixture of medieval German and Hebrew. And when we lived in Eastern Europe. So in Eastern Europe, we had a lot of potatoes. We didn't have so much in the way of, but for some reason, we didn't do what the Sephardics do. And the Sephardic Jews have a traditional food called sufganiyot, and they're little jelly donuts. But they're so good that a lot of Ashkenazic people make souvganiyot too. Why wouldn't you? And I'm assuming that Sephardi people will make latkes as well. They're both delicious. And the tradition is it's just that it's deep fried. And so you're eating stuff in oil because of the miracle of the oil. The other thing you do is you play dreidel. So you see this top that's on my shirt? What you're looking at, unfortunately the letters are backwards because I haven't figured out how to film this flipped. Anyway, so what you can see on this dreidel, it's a four-sided top that you spin and you gimbal. And what you see on this shirt, this is a gimel and this is the hay. And there's a nun. And if you're outside of Israel, there's a shin. And if you're in Israel, there's a pe. So it's nun, gimel, hay, shin, which stands for Nes Gadol Hayasham, a great miracle happened there. If you're in Israel, it's Nes Gadol Hayapo. So there's going to be a pe on it. And so the game is you spin the dreidel. It's going to fall. One of the sides is going to be up and you have a pot. And you could play with pennies, you could play high stakes, you could play with Bitcoin, I suppose. But people tend to play with M&Ms or some other kind of candy, raisins, nuts, whatever. And you have those in a pot, and depending on what you twirled, you either get the whole pot, you have to put one in, you skip a turn, or you, let me see. So none, you get nothing. Gadol, I think you get the whole pot. Hay, you maybe get one, and then Sham, you put one in. I'm not sure. I would have to look it up to tell you exactly. But that's what you do, and you gamble. It's a fun game that you play. And, you know, you can get really great, beautiful, ornate dreidels, medium-sized dreidels that are made of wood, and you can get cheap plastic ones that that come with your... when you buy your candles, you know, you can get 6 packs of little plastic ones, and you get 6 packs of little wooden ones as well. So you play dreidel, and you give presents. So do you know why you give presents on... It used to be that all you did on Hanukkah was you got Hanukkah geld. So you got a little money. And then money turned into chocolate money, which is fun for kids. You know, you get the little chocolate coins. That's kind of a tradition. And then the reason that now you get a present every night on your 8 crazy nights, thank you, Adam Sandler, there's two words, Madison Avenue. That's why it wasn't a tradition to give tons of gifts at Hanukkah until Madison Avenue happened. I'm not sure if they do it like we do in the U.S. all over the world, but it's because the reason we give so many presents on Hanukkah is because we give so many presents at Christmas. That's why. You don't have to. The other thing you should know about Hanukkah is that in the hierarchy of importance of holidays in Judaism, Hanukkah is way down there. I don't think Hanukkah has a yuntif, meaning you could go to work every day on Hanukkah. It's not a Yom Tov where you're not supposed to work. Like, it's not a Shabbat where you're not supposed to work. It's an apocryphal holiday. The events of Hanukkah happened after the Bible happened. So it's not anywhere near as important as Christmas or Easter. Christmas and Easter are 2 big holidays in Christianity. Hanukkah falls around the same time as Christmas, and it's nowhere near as important. Our most important holidays would be Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah. Those are the most important holidays of the year, and what most Jews, if they celebrate anything, they celebrate that. And followed probably by Passover, and that would be the second most important holiday. There are 4 8-day festivals in the Jewish calendar, and one for each season, because, you know, you celebrate the seasons. If you have an agricultural history, you're going to celebrate based on the seasons and what the fruits are doing, what the fruits in the harvest are doing. So you have your spring festival, which is going to be Passover. You have your summer festival, which is the first harvest, and that's Shavuot. And then you have your fall festival, which is the fall harvest, and that's Sukkot. And then you have your winter festival, which is your light festival, so you can be cheery and happy during the wintertime, and that's Hanukkah. So, and they're all super fun holidays. Those are fun, joyous holidays. And people think of, oh, the Jewish holidays are kind of somber because they think of Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah. But But most of Judaism is there's a lot of celebration. There's a lot of wine that happens. You know, you drink wine on every Shabbat, and you drink lots of wine on Purim. When Purim comes, I'll tell you about Purim, but I usually talk about Purim every year. Purim is a super fun holiday, and Purim is another apocryphal holiday, and it's celebrated similarly to Mardi Gras. Why is it celebrated that way? Because of Mardi Gras. It happens at about roughly the same time of year, and it's celebrated roughly the same way. You get all dressed up. I don't know people definitely have, Mardi Gras beads, but you get dressed up in costume. You can get dressed up as the characters of Purim, or you can get dressed up as Elphaba and Glinda, or, you know, Star Trek, or whatever you want to do, and go to parties and party and drink till you can't tell the difference between the bad guy and the good guy, between Haman and Mordecai. Anyway, so being Jewish is actually fun. It really is, except when you're getting persecuted. That's not fun. But the holidays in Judaism are a lot of fun. I mean, I don't like wish I were not Jewish so I could celebrate Christmas. And in fact, because my partner celebrates Christmas, I get to have some of the best parts of Christmas anyway. But being Jewish, if you celebrate Jewish holidays, it's fun. There's a lot of joy and there's a lot of celebration. And you eat a lot of food and you have to be careful you don't gain weight because the food's really good. I mean, challah, which is, you know, traditional braided Jewish loaf, is delicious. Rugelach, which are these little Eastern European pastries, are so good. It's a cream cheese based dough, and they can be chocolate or chocolate raspberry or apricot or cinnamon. So good. And there's blintzes, and there's latkes, and there's sufganiyot, and lots of other traditional Jewish stuff. That it's great. It's really fun to be Jewish, and I like to talk about it because not everybody knows about Judaism. You know, people don't really. You know, people we're so concerned right now because of the terrible, terrible things that are going on in Israel right now. And you should know that lots of Jews wish that wasn't going on at all. They don't approve of what Netanyahu is doing, and we want a two-state solution, and we want the war to end. And there are lots of Jews in Israel who feel that way, just like there are people here on both sides of the fence in terms of what's going on with the government. Well, it's the same way with Jews all over the world, and Jews specifically in Israel. And yet, it's important not to conflate Jews all over the world with what's going on in Israel, because a lot of us don't want it to be happening. And just because you're Jewish doesn't mean that you think that should be going on. And just because you're Jewish doesn't mean you don't care about the Palestinians and the plight of the Palestinians, because I personally do, and lots of Jews do. So it's a good idea to not be anti-Semitic, because, you know, we are human beings like anybody else. And a lot of us are not in favor of what's going on. We would like, I don't know what's going to happen when that war ends and they need to rebuild Gaza. I don't know how that's going to happen. If I were queen, there would be a huge effort to rebuild Gaza and rebuild a beautiful state for the Palestinian people and, keep the terrorists away, but have a wonderful Palestinian state and help them to instate their own government and have their own self-governance and have them be, have them have a good relationship with Israel. And Israel really needs to do teshuva and help Gaza to rebuild. That really needs to happen. Because what happened there is terrible. I mean, on the one hand, they want to stop rockets firing into Israel, but on the other hand, so many innocent people suffered. So many Palestinians suffered as a result of that. So think twice when you're being mean to your Jewish friends because you're far to the left and you're neither Palestinian nor Jewish. It's very painful for us. It's really, really painful for us to watch that war going on. And a lot of us don't want it to be going on. And we would like the Palestinians to have their own state. And we want a good solution for that to happen. All right, so that's Hanukkah. So let me see if there's anything else I want to talk about regarding Hanukkah. Okay, let's see. I told you about Madison Avenue. Let's talk about Kwanzaa, because Kwanzaa begins, if you're listening on January 1st, Kwanzaa began on December 26th, And remember, I talked about it a little bit last week. Kwanzaa was created in the 1960s. It was started by Maulana Karenga, who is a Black nationalist who became a college professor. And he modeled it on the traditional African festivals and took the name Kwanzaa from the Swahili phrase Matunda ya Kwanzaa, which means first fruits. And the extra A was added to accommodate seven children as the first at the first ever Kwanzaa celebration who wanted to represent a letter. And the letters are an acronym for different principles. And I'll tell you about those in a minute. So it's thought of as an alternative to Christmas, but people celebrate both because it's not a religious holiday. And we talked about that last week. So here's the seven principles. Principles, as determined by Karenga, are umoja, which is unity, kujichagulia, self-determination, ujima, collective work and responsibility, ujama, cooperative economics, Nia, purpose, and I do, I'm trained to teach a body, mind, fitness art called Nia, and that's one of the meanings of Nia, which is with purpose. So it's also non-impact aerobics and neuromuscular integrative action, and it's just its own thing. And then there's Kuumba, which is creativity, and Imani, which is faith. And so those are the seven principles of Kwanzaa. Kwanzaa also has seven symbols. Mazao, which is the crops, Mkeka, which is a mat, Kinara, which is a candle holder, Muhindi, which is corn, Kikombe Chaumoja, which is a unity cup, Zawadi, which is gifts, and Mishuma Saba, which is seven candles that are traditionally arranged on a table that kind of looks like a menorah. Three of the seven candles are red, representing the struggle, and three are green, representing land and hope for the future. One is black, representing the people of African descent. And some families who celebrate Kwanzaa dress up or decorate their homes in those colors. So in order to avoid over-commercialization, gifts handed to family members on the last day of Kwanzaa are often homemade. Some participants buy books, music, art accessories, or culturally themed products, preferably from a black-owned business. And U.S. presidents habitually wish the nation a happy Kwanzaa, which is great. Despite not observing the holiday, former President Barack Obama and his wife Michelle issued a statement in 2011 to all those celebrating Kwanzaa. We know that there are still too many Americans going through enormous challenges and trying to make ends meet, the president said. But we also know that in the spirit of unity, or umoja, we can overcome those challenges together. Presidents Bill Clinton and George W. Bush released similar statements during their time in office. The holiday also made inroads with the U.S. Postal Service, which has issued stamps since 1997. And I went to the post office to mail some stuff on the other day, and the holiday stamps were out. And there were Hanukkah stamps, beautiful Hanukkah, a couple different options for Hanukkah stamps. I still have Hanukkah stamps for last year because I don't send a lot of letters anymore. I don't send a lot of physical mail. I used to mail bills, and there's very few bills that I pay physically with a check. Most of my bills are paid online. Even my rent to for the house and for my business, I do on Venmo now. So many things. So I go through stamps very slowly. So I'm reluctant to buy stamps. Sometimes I buy them just because they're pretty. And I might go ahead and buy those pretty Art Deco Hanukkah stamps because they are very pretty and just use them all year. So that's Kwanzaa. So know that it's, if you're listening on New Year's Day, it is Kwanzaa right now. And it will, Kwanzaa, today's the, New Year's Day is the last day of Kwanzaa. All right, so let's, we have a little over about 15 minutes left. Let's talk about some New Year's resolutions. Should we do New Year's resolutions or should we do New Year's traditions around the world? I think what I'm going to do is talk about the New Year's traditions around the world, and then we'll talk about actual resolutions when we're back live in 2 weeks. So, because I'm interested in this New Year's resolutions around the world. Or traditions around the world. So here's some traditions here's some different New Year's traditions around the world. So in a lot of countries, they eat lucky foods. Through the world, New Year's Eve is celebrated with a meal in the company of friends and family. When I lived in Newfoundland, New Year's Day dinner was a big deal. It wasn't New Year's Eve, it was New Year's Day. You would have a special dinner with your family. And places eat lucky foods. In Spain, Portugal, and a lot of Latin America, they eat 12 grapes or raisins, and in Italy, 12 spoonfuls of lentils, one with each of the 12 chimes of the clock at midnight. So That's for good luck for the good new year. The French usher in the best new year with a stack of pancakes. Germans prefer marzipan shaped into a pig for luck. Now, my mother loves marzipan, but I would probably not give her one in the shape of a pig. In the Netherlands, they eat donuts and ring-shaped foods. Good old donuts. In Estonia, as many as 7, 9, or even 12 times on New Year's Eve, they believe for each meal consumed, the person games, they feast 7, 9, or 12 times. Ugh, that's a lot of food. Across the U.S., communities have collard greens and black-eyed peas for luck and prosperity on New Year's Day. Collard greens are chosen for their color. The green symbolizes money. In Scotland, they do the redding of the house and they sing Auld Lang Syne. So Hogmanay is an end-of-year New Year's Eve party that starts on December 30th, my mother's birthday, and ends on New Year's Day. There are many variations of Hogmanay celebrations through the country, but the most common tradition is first footing, which involves being the first to visit friends and neighbors, often with a symbolic gift in hand. People gather to sing Auld Lang Syne, which is sung everywhere, but is originally Scottish. As the clock strikes midnight, but one of the most important New Year's traditions is the redding of the house. This is essentially a deep clean around your home from the cabinets to the front door. One spot that's focused on is the fireplace. Old ashes are cleaned out so everyone in the house can start the year afresh. And I just remembered something. I had a friend a long time ago. I worked with a woman from Pittsburgh. And I remember two things that were Pittsburgh things to say. And I don't know if all of Western Pennsylvania says this, but they definitely say it in Pittsburgh. And one of the things they say is to red up the house. Redding up the house means to straighten up. And I didn't realize that's a Scottish thing. And that's where it comes from. And the other thing is rubber bands are not rubber bands. They are gum bands. And I don't know if that's only in Pittsburgh, but it's definitely in Pittsburgh. So I had heard red up as a Pittsburgh thing, but it's originally Scottish. Did not know that until I was today years old when I found that out. If you're in Edinburgh, which is in Scotland, an international city in Scotland, you'll see pipers and drummers leading torch-wielding locals on processions through the city on the 30th. And on New Year's Day, the party ends with a swim in the chilly waters of the Firth of Forth. And I went to Scotland because I almost married a Scottish guy, but it didn't happen. But I did visit Scotland twice, once in 1985 and again in 86, or maybe it was 86 and 87. Anyway, so somewhere in there, I went to Scotland and I went to the Firth. I was near the Firth of Forth. Firth of Forth sounds funny. A Firth, I believe, is a river. That is what a Firth is. And there's the Firth of Clyde and there's all these different rivers that are called the Firth of whatever. In the Philippines, they wear polka dots and eat round fruits. Round shapes like polka dots promote prosperity and good luck. Additionally, it's common to eat round fruits like oranges, watermelons, longan, grapes, and pomelos. Pomelos are like a kind of like a cross between an orange and a grapefruit. And I know that I met an Israeli woman who said one of her favorite fruits was pomelos, and she told me what they were. And I think we can get them sometimes at the Willy Co-op. So eating those round fruits are fortuitous as well. And for kids, you jump as high as you can as soon as midnight hits, and they think it'll help them grow taller in the new year. In Brazil, they wear white and jump into the ocean. You can do that in Brazil because it's warm enough. I won't be in Florida on New Year's. I'm not going to Florida until the 4th, and not the Firth of Forth. But on the 4th of January, I will be going to Florida. So we wear white on New Year's Eve. That has a long tradition with roots in Africa. And in Brazil, they have the Festa de la Manhã, which takes place on New Year's night to celebrate the goddess of the sea, who is Limanha. The culmination of the event, where everyone dressed in white runs into the water at midnight to jump over 7 waves. Each wave jump signifies a different request the swimmer is making to a different orisha or god. So this goes back to Yoruba tradition. So the orishas are in the Yoruba tradition. So they have orishas. I guess they have them in Brazil. They have them in Creole culture in New Orleans, and they have them in Santeria. Although they're called the Santos, and the Santos in Santeria are related to, they just have the names changed to a saint, but they are also the Orishas. It's the same thing. So, and in Haiti as well, they have the, because anyone who has a Yoruba background is going to have Orishas, and Santeria is, all they did was they renamed the Orishas with the name of a saint because they weren't supposed to practice their native religion, which is terrible. But they maintain those traditions in Brazil, so they must have Yoruba folks. The Yoruba people are from Nigeria. And I'm pretty sure I saw Cynthia Erivo's name. Her full name is a very long Nigerian. Between Cynthia and Erivo, she has a very long Nigerian name. I'm pretty sure that that's Yoruba. The only reason I know that is because I recognize some of the words and sounds from watching Bob Loves Abishola. And one of the cool things about that TV show, Bob Loves Abishola, is it brought Nigerian culture to your average American, and there were things I didn't know and that I learned because of Bob and Abishola, and that they have very long, very meaningful names that are about prosperity and giving and caring and unity and community, so her very long name probably has very special meaning, and I hope I can find out what that is, but anyway, I'm pretty sure Cynthia Erivo is of Yoruba descent. Her parents are Nigerian, of Nigerian descent. She grew up in Britain, which is common. And the lingua franca of the European language of Nigeria is English, whereas other African countries speak a different European language depending on who conquered them. So, but the British had an interest in Nigeria at one time. And of course in Jamaica, they also speak English, whereas in Haiti, they speak Creole, Haitian Creole, which has French in it. And then in Sierra Leone, they speak French, and in Liberia, they speak English because Liberia was founded, for the slaves the American slaves to return to Africa. Although they have people who live in Liberia who, are not descendants of people who were American slaves. They're people who were the people who never left Africa there as well. I believe that is who my brother-in-law is descended from. He's Liberian. So in Mexico, you walk around with an empty suitcase. Why would you do that? It's not heavy. And it symbolizes getting to travel and having new experience. In other Latin American countries, people walk around with an empty suitcase or set it in the middle of a room and stroll around it. Others go further and take a full lap around the block with the empty luggage. And then in Cuba, you throw a bucket of water out the front door. In Cuba, people symbolically gather all the bad spirits and negative energy from the past 365 days and toss them out the front door. It's not unusual to see buckets full of dirty water flying out of homes during the countdown to midnight. Watch if you find yourself strolling through a Cuban neighborhood on New Year's Eve. I had a Cuban novio, Cuban boyfriend, many years ago. And when I was with him, we lived in Nova Scotia at the time. So he wanted to go for a walk on the beach and throw pennies into the water. So that was also another tradition for New Year's. In Greece, they hang and smash pomegranates. So Puerto Rico, which is a Greek custom word that roughly translates to good foot, it aims to bring luck at the start of the year. Before the holiday, households will hang pomegranates, thought to be a sign of luck, prosperity, and fertility. You know, it's round, it's the shape of a heart. And it's thought, I think the fertility, because you open it up and there's lots of seeds inside. Then on New Year's Eve, just before midnight, everyone shuts off the lights and leaves the house so they can send a lucky individual to be the first to re-enter the house, right foot first. And when it's done right, it brings the family good fortune for the year. And then a second person takes the pomegranate in the right hand and smashes it against the door to see just how much luck. The more seeds that spill out, the more luck you'll get in that new year. In Germany, they melt lead to divine the future. In much of German-speaking Europe, as well as Finland, Bulgaria, and Chechnya, and Turkey, it's customary to heat small pieces of lead, then cast them in cold water and make a prediction for the new year based on the shapes that form. So if a ball forms, luck will roll your way. These days, kids throughout German-speaking countries include tin rather than lead figurines to melt, because tin's a little safer than lead. Lead is kind of toxic. In Russia, they have 12 seconds of silence before midnight, which is very nice. They say thank you to the past year by remembering its most important events during the hours leading up to midnight, and they use 12 seconds of silence before the stroke of midnight to make wishes. So they're not counting down out loud like we do in the U.S. In Spain, they search for the man with many noses. And so it's a special character on the last day of the year. L'homme dels nasos, or the man with many noses. I don't think that's straight up Spanish. That might be a dialect, and I don't know which one. So the man with many noses has as many noses as there are days left in the year, and if he grants wishes, you can find him. According to the Spanish tradition, children are encouraged to look for him, rarely realizing that on the last day of the year, he only has one nose left, and it's hard to spot because everybody has one nose. In Denmark, you jump into the new year. So you jump off a chair or a sofa, where you're jumping into the new year. It's seen as good luck if you do and bad luck if you don't. So if you're in Denmark, make sure you take a leap. Or if you're Danish and you're not in Denmark. My Uncle Bent never told me that. God rest his soul. In Ireland, they set an extra place at the table, just like we do on Passover. So they have several New Year's traditions, like banging the outside walls of their houses with bread to keep away bad luck and evil spirits, and start the year with a spotless, fleshly, clean home. So they red up too. But one of the most well-known is setting an additional plate at the dinner table for anyone loved ones lost in the past year. In Italy and Spain, you wear red underwear. They wear red underwear for luck, but Spaniards insist the underwear has to be new to be lucky. Italians take it a little further. They often throw old items out the window to simulate the coming of new things in the new year. And in Japan, they visit a temple for lucky charms. So New Year's traditions have a wholesome focus. Shogatsu, New Year, is usually celebrated with a visit to the local temple to exchange last year's lucky charms, omamori, for new ones, and afterwards people will feast on traditional New Year foods like prunes, begin to bring a long life, and herring roe to boost fertility. So those are some lovely traditions from around the world that people participate in on New Year's. And I am hoping that you have a lovely New Year. It's 2025. And next week we'll talk about some New Year, some resolutions that you can actually keep, and maybe some more resolutions. And then we'll get back to talking about things that can be helpful for treating osteoarthritis, because I have a lot more to talk about on that scope. And beyond that, we have supplements to help you with fat loss, which is often people's chief resolution, that they want to lose weight. So I'm going to let you go. You have been listening to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. My co-host Ron Meniza will be making his shows on a different day for the month of December because he's teaching a fitness class at our usual time. You can email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, and Buzzsprout. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at Fran Storch ND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on this show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores, and WHUS.org.